I'm Wesley Aylesbury of the Ostringer weblog, www.ostringer.net/WP. I'm going to give you my week's end roundup for February 11th, 2005. First up, my health. Monday and Tuesday were relatively poor days, where I had abdominal pain intermittently a fair part of both days, and very little sleep on Monday night. I was able to go into the office in Oakland on Wednesday and Thursday, and things were okay with me there. I spent today at home working on my yearly report for my job. Some ups, some downs, and here we are at the weekend. Second, I gave a talk on Thursday. It was for the Animal Behavior Lunch Seminar at UC Berkeley. I titled it Biosonar, Bioenergetics, and Behavior, Click Sound Production in the Atlantic Bottlenose Dolphin. I had planned to make a tape of the lecture, but I unfortunately forgot to start the tape. Duh. Fortunately, I did deliver the lecture. I went over my dissertation research, basically relating this to behavior in two ways. The dolphins were trained to do biosonar tasks with operant conditioning techniques. The information that we learned from the research should be useful in thinking about how dolphin behavior enters into dolphin ecology and influenced evolution. The latter part is highly speculative, but it seems to me that an argument can be made for the ancestors of odontocetes using sound produced in the nasal passages underwater for the purposes of social cohesion, and then perhaps was exapted for use in biosonar. Nasal sound production has several advantages over laryngeal sound production for dolphins. Because they just have to compress gas within the bony nasal passages, they can expend less work than trying to up the pressure in the lungs. Further, this mechanism will work down below 70 meters depth, which is where studies have shown dolphins to exhibit complete collapse of the lungs. I'll explain a bit about the research now. This was a study done in 1999 with Ted Cranford of San Diego State University as principal investigator. We took measurements of the pressure inside the bony nasal passages of dolphins while they performed the biosonar task. We also used an endoscope to view various structures while the dolphins made their clicks. What we confirmed from previous studies was that the pressure inside the bony nasal passages increased before sounds were produced, that pressure was higher in general when the dolphin produced whistles than when the dolphin produced clicks, and that sound production occurred in the nasal passages between the blowhole and the bony nasal passage. What we found was evidence for click and whistle sound production occurring at the phonic lips. Dolphins have a pair of lip-like structures located about an inch below the blowhole, dividing the spiracular cavity. These are where the sound production action takes place. Our veterinarian, Bill Von Bonn, was able to interfere with these phonic lips during attempted sound production. With interference, the dolphin could not produce requested sounds. When the endoscope was moved very slightly out of the way of the phonic lips, they could produce sounds on request. The tip of the larynx remained tightly sealed during sound production. We also quantified the pressure increase inside the bony nasal passages for click sound production and whistle sound production. With these values and a little bit of modeling, we were able to estimate the mechanical work involved in pressurizing the gas in the bony nasal passages. We estimated that the average pressurization event associated with biosonar click trains took about 10 joules of work and was about 5 watts of power dissipation. That's the mechanical work figure. The energy expended in physiological work is going to be several times higher. When we considered how that would change with increasing depth, we concluded that the work required to obtain a fixed intranarial pressure difference would increase modestly with increasing depth. In an example calculation, it took 10 joules of work at the surface. What took 10 joules of work at the surface took about 12 joules at 10 atmospheres of pressure, or about 90 meters depth. In other research news, I've gotten comments back on a paper submitted for clearance through the Navy Marine Mammal Program. Essentially, there are a variety of formatting issues, plus cutting various parts of it to make it shorter. This was a paper discussing the methods used to measure intranarial pressure and bioacoustics simultaneously, and it also reported on the average intranarial pressure during events when clicks were produced versus those when both clicks and whistles were produced. Once the paper clears the Navy review process, I can send it on to a journal. It has taken a while, but progress is being made. Okay, third topic, teaching evolutionary biology. There are a flurry of legislative measures in various states seeking to implement anti-evolution policies. For example, there is Georgia House Bill 179, entered by Representative Bridges of the 10th District. I'll just read it to you. A bill to be entitled, An Act, to amend Part 2 of Article 6 of Chapter 2 of Title 20 of the Official Code of Georgia, annotated, relating to competencies in core curriculum in elementary and secondary schools, so as to provide for the presentation of certain scientific evidence whenever any theory of the origin of humans or other living things is taught, to provide for legislative intent, to provide an effective date, to repeal conflicting laws, and for other purposes. Be it enacted by the General Assembly of Georgia, Section 1, Part 2 of Article 6 of Chapter 2 of Title 20 of the Official Code of Georgia, annotated, relating to competencies in core curriculum in elementary and secondary schools, is amended by adding at the end thereof a new code section to be designated as Code Section 20-2-148, to read as follows. A. Whenever any theory of the origin of humans or other living things is included in a course of study offered by a local unit of administration, factual scientific evidence supporting or consistent with evolution theory, and factual scientific evidence inconsistent with or not supporting the theory, shall be included in the course of study. B. The method of instruction described in subsection A of this code section is intended to strengthen the analytical skills of students by requiring the presentation of a broad range of scientific evidence regarding theories of the origin of humans and other living things. The requirements of subsection A of this code section are not intended to authorize or promote the presentation of religious beliefs. Section 2. This act shall become effective on July 1, 2005. Section 3. All laws and parts of laws in conflict with this act are repealed. You can just Google for Georgia House Bill 179 and you'll find the text online. This is an example of an evidence against evolution type bill. What these bills seek to do is open the door for teachers to use standard anti-evolution arguments that are common to intelligent design and creation science in the science classrooms. The idea is that those sources falsely claim the objections that they are making to be scientific in nature. The fact is, though, that none of these have withstood scientific scrutiny. None. There is a large resource on the Talk Origins archive at www.talkorigins.org. devoted to brief summaries of the responses to every known creationist argument. It is called the Index to Creationist Claims. It was compiled by Mark Isaac, who has a book contract for this work. This sort of policy is the culmination of 15 years of fumbling by anti-evolutionists for a strategy to get away from things that are obviously establishments of religion. This is what they hope will fool the courts into thinking that there is not a religious purpose, effect, or entanglement to the bill. When it gets down to it, there is no established precedent on teaching bad science, pseudoscience, or just plain nonsense to kids and calling it science. So this bill sets up schools nicely in that they essentially have no other sources for so-called evidence inconsistent with evolution except the long-discredited stuff being pushed by anti-evolutionists. Other sources, though, are likely to take advantage of the opportunity offered. How long do you suppose it will be before the UFO cult of the Raelians decides to provide science classes with their anti-evolutionary materials, or some of the Hindu materials claiming that humans have existed for billions of years? That material will be just as appropriate for instruction, or just as inappropriate, if laws such as this are passed. Okay, fourth item, stuff to do with computers. I'm looking into various content management systems. I'm already using the PostNuke system for an intranet site. I've made a base install of the CivicSpace content management system. This is a package based on Drupal. It looks like it has a lot of features that I want right out of the box, including the ability to establish a taxonomic style of topics, yielding a hierarchy. Another cool point is the path alias property, which allows you to set a simple path for a URL to the page or resource. This means that you aren't stuck with cryptic parameters making up the right-hand side of the URL. A problem that I have with Civic Space that may be a deal breaker is that I want to set it up to be accessed both on an intranet and from the internet as well, but it seems to be very sensitive to whether a domain name or a dotted quad address is used to request pages. When set up from the internet using a domain name, access from the intranet using a dotted quad takes several minutes to load the home page, and trying to log in from there consistently fails. If someone has a suggestion, please let me know. I'm also looking into content management systems for coursework. I found a couple of interesting possibilities there, Moodle and Logicampus. A test install of Logicampus has me scratching my head. The password instructions don't seem to match what is actually installed. There's a demo that comes with the install that gets some of the data in the MySQL tables even if I uncheck the Load Demo Box checkbox during installation. I haven't tried installing MoodleNet yet. Maybe next week. I have a bunch of legacy media. No, I'm not talking about newspapers like some bloggers do. I'm talking about my boxes of floppy disks that go back to 1984 and some of my CD-ROMs that are approaching 10 years old themselves. I want to extract as much of the data as I can from these and stop having to move them with me. I've made a script for my FreeBSD 5.3 box that does a good job on 1.44 megabyte floppies, but I haven't figured out 360 kilobyte 5.25-inch floppies yet. Another thing that would be good to reduce are the boxes and boxes of audio tapes. There are a bunch of lectures, events, and in some cases bioacoustic data that should be moved to digital storage. I'm looking to hook up a tape player to a sound card in one of the machines here. The Audacity open-source sound editing package looks like it will do a fine job for this. I can choose to save as WAV, PCM, or MP3 from Audacity, and in fact that is the application that I'm using for making this recording, too. Fifth category, photography. I haven't done much with photography recently, though my sister Emily Kay and her husband Mike May sent me a package from Australia. This included a very nice tripod that was missing just one part. I've put in an order for that part, so hopefully within the next month or so I will have it fully functional. They also sent some shirts from Down Under. Thanks, Kay and Mike. There are some cool things coming out in digital photography. Once I'm able to pay off my expenses for past photo purchases, I'm looking to get a 12-24mm lens. On my Fuji S2 digital camera, this will give me the field of view of an 18mm lens at the wide end. I'm thinking of going with the Sigma 12-24, which gives coverage for full-frame 35mm and is cheaper than the Nikon 12-24 lens. I have missed having a very wide angle. Sixth category, falconry. Diane went to a field trial at Los Banos last weekend. She took Rusty and Glamdring along with her and the two Vishlas, Farley and Rika. Rika failed to place in her event, but she did find birds on her outing. Diane got the loan of a horse, so she spent last Saturday viewing other braces run. She took Rusty and Glamdring, the Harris Hawks, out hunting at a location not too far from the field trial site, and she saw rabbits, cottontail rabbits, not just jackrabbits. And it has been a while. Cottontail rabbits are pretty uncommon around the East Bay area, so Rusty and Glamdring got in some flights, although they didn't catch anything while Diane was watching. However, Rusty connected with something because Diane lost track of her for a while. Eventually, Diane found Rusty, stuffed with something and hanging out in a tree. Diane could not get Rusty to come down, so she had to wait until the following morning before Rusty got enough of an appetite to want to come to the glove and be put in the van. Diane gave Glamdring a thawed quail, so both birds had nice full crops for the drive home. That about wraps it up. I hope you like this experiment in podcasting and will be back to listen to more. Be sure to check my blog, www.ostringer.net/WP, from time to time. Also take a look at the Panda's Thumb weblog, www.pandasthumb.org. The Panda's Thumb is up for a Kofax Award for the best group blog. If you vote before next Friday, February 17th, you can make a difference in which group blog gets this honor. The voting is at the Wampum weblog, wampum.wabanaki.net. Take care. If you think science has made your life better, you might do well to thank a scientist for helping. Actually, thanking anyone that helps out is a good thing to do. I recommend it. Goodbye.